was from, you never know what I'll say without my glasses.
Or C.
So this is Blue Cliff Records, Case 89. The Hands and Eyes of the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion. Kuan Yin, Avalokiteshvara. So the pointer. In your whole body, if your whole body were an eye, you still wouldn't be able to see it. If your whole body were an ear, you still wouldn't be able to hear it. If your whole body were a mouth, you still wouldn't be able to speak it. If your whole body were a mind, you still wouldn't be able to perceive it. Now, leaving aside whole body for the moment, if suddenly you had no eyes, how would you see? Without ears, how would you hear? Without a mouth, how would you speak? Without a mind, how would you perceive? Here, if you can unfurl a single pathway, then you'd be a fellow student with the ancient Buddhas. But leaving aside studying for the moment, under whom would you study? So now this clarifies the whole case. The case goes on, and I'm sure we've heard this a number of times from different places. Yun Yan asked Dao Wu, what does the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion use or so many hands and eyes for? We do know that the Bodhisattva of Compassion has 10,000 or 84,000 eyes and hands. Have you seen figures representing her? Wu said, it's like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow in the middle of the night. Where is that thing? No lights, it's dark. Feeling. Well, that feels like a pillow. I don't remember the lecture, but I remember Dick Baker giving a talk about this this koan, and I particularly remember the story of reaching back for the pillow in the night. So Wu says, it's like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow in the middle of the night. Yen said, I understand. So of course the notes say about Yen, he adds error on error. He's cheating everyone. There's no different dirt in the same hole. Yun Yan doesn't avoid running afoul of the pointer and cutting his hand. So how do you understand it? Wu says. The guy says, I understand. And then Wu says to him, how do you understand? Now, most of us think like this is a, what? A confrontation. The fact is that Wu and Yen had been practicing together for 40 years. And they knew quite well one another and how they understood. So Wu asks him, How do you understand it? And Yen said, all over the body are hands and eyes. So you can imagine your body just bulging with eyes, fingertips, lips, head, chin, breasts, thighs, and hands too. Everywhere. So Wu says to him, you said quite a bit there, but you've only said 80% of it. What does six say? The note says, back to dirt in the same hole. It's great. There's no different dirt in the same hole. When the manservant sees the maidservant, he takes care. A leper drags along his companions. The point here, though, is 80%. It's something that Dogen continually refers to as, and how he works with these Zen stories, is that nothing is ever 100%. 100% of 80%. There's always something left unsayable, unanswerable. So these are responses, but not answers. These are expressions of experience, but not answers like an answer on a test that would be the correct answer for everyone. This is Wu's understanding. It's not Yen's understanding. So, or it's Yen's understanding, not Wu's. So Yen turns around and says to Wu, what do you say, elder brother? And Wu says, throughout the body are hands and eyes. And we might consider what is the difference between throughout the body and all over the body. All over the body on the surface, throughout the body, throughout the interior, throughout our organs and bones and marrow, are these hands and eyes of compassion. There's this being, a bodhisattva, referred to as a bodhisattva, but he was, as I understand it, made up somewhere in the 9th century in China, named Agen. And Agen is like the bodhisattva of love and relationships. And Agen is the bodhisattva who tames the passions and turns them into love and relationship. And Agen is this bald red creature, glowing red creature. And it's said of Agen that he's red because the expression of love and compassion comes all the way from his marrow, out through his bones, through his muscles, and through his skin, and turns everything red. So if our whole body were an eye, or our whole body were an ear, or a mouth, or if our whole body were a mind. The expression in Zen is often listen, listen with your elbow, listen with your knees, see with your ears. What what are we talking about? So this eye and this mind and these ears, of course, hearken to one expression we have, which is the Heart Sutra, of which there are none of these things, or in which there are none of these things. And still, we eat, and we speak, and we see. There is seeing, there is speaking, there is hearing, there is feeling, there's smelling. We'll just say it like this. Yeah, the nature of Zazen, the nature of Zen sitting, is yogic. And often in the West, we practice it mentally. But the nature of sitting emerges from within, as over the years we sit still. It's a little bit like the movie The Alien, when the symbiont bursts out. That's what happens to us, you know, when we're sitting here and our body is tight and resistant, and we're we'd like to be anyplace else, but right here. And our knees hurt, and our back hurts, and our guts hurt. Or at best, we're bored to death. We're resisting the symbiont. We're resisting letting go of our core. Core means heart. But this heart is from here, from our perineum to the top of our head. So when we sit Zazen, you know, everybody gives Zazen instruction, and there's the Fuken Zanzenji, and there's sitting up straight, there's our shoulders over our pelvis, there's our chin in a slight bit, our lips are lightly shut, touching, our teeth lightly touching, tongues at the front roof of the mouth, eyes are open, feeling of rise from the top of the head. And it's an interesting thing. So in Western skeletons, in the medical schools, the head is up like this. So the top of the head, the center of the head is here. In the Chinese world, the chin is down, slight bit, not like this, but in a slight bit, and the center of the head moves further back. And what happens is when our chin is slightly in, not stiffly in, is our occipital region is open, and the way the spine goes into the head is open. And as my Qigong teacher says, it's bobblicious. You know, like those dolls on the dashboards with the New York Jets banging their heads against the dashboard because they're doing so poorly. But yeah, you know, that some feeling like that. And then this, when the chin's in, straight through the head, down through the throat, down through the body, inside the thoracic cavity, all the way directly to the perineum, is like a pole, an axis, on which we are. So Norman in the Sesshin in June basically said, sits bones, solar plexus, front of the chest here, feeling of rise here, chin in, and rising from the top of the head. But this breathing, it's not like we're pulling ourselves up. It's like as we breathe, it's almost like we're breathing in from our butt. And it's filling us and opening us around this axis. As we begin to awaken to our body this way, then the experience of the whole body as an eye or an ear doesn't sound like some wild experiment or some wild statement. It's actually like the story about, if you read Mountains and Rivers, is it Mountains and Rivers? Mountains and something
mountains
or other.
Mountains and Water.
Mountains and Water. Waters. Where he talks about being a huge Buddha and then a small Buddha. He talks about grass. And then there's also the story about the piece of grass being the temple. I put it right here. It's not in the Dogen piece there. But this sense and awareness of our body, our sense and awareness of being, changes and is in flux and frees us from our habituated, controlled view of the world. It's like when we're trained in how a sentence should be written, syntax and grammar, there's a certain idea about how it should be written. And that idea and that way of writing actually totally affects how we perceive and put the world together. Likewise, if we're taught perspective, we sense that a way should be smaller, and there's rectangles in the world, and parallel lines, and squares. And when we look in nature, there are no rectangles. There are no straight lines and there are no squares. So in some way we put the trees and the grass and the distance in a viewfinder that we always carry around with us. And we're seeing. And we make a lot of assumptions. After a while, we're actually trained to read sentences so fast that we can extract information that we think is there that's inferred. But if you're a good historian and you actually read the document, you can find all sorts of stuff that nobody noticed. I'm reading a book called In the Shadows of the American Empire, by a man named Alfred McCoy, who's a historian he's been at the University of Wisconsin for many years. He splashed onto the scene in the 70s writing a book called The Politics of Heroin. Hmm? The CIA and Empire. and this recent book is an extension of that, but he's making an argument about the demise of the American Empire and the rise of China, possibly in the near future, in the next, by 2030, he says. But the thing that he talks about in his methodology, the historian, is that people don't realize that historians, good ones, actually read the documents. Not only do they request them from the government with whatever rights you can get, but to get them after the 10 years or the 50 years, but then they actually read them. And there was one document where, if you may remember, this has a lot to do with the Zen here, but there was one document that he read that he requested in the mid-90s that had to do with the Iran Contra event and the CIA's involvement with how shall I say, protecting certain interests so that crack cocaine could be distributed in L.A. And he read the document, and he copied the document that he had. And throughout the time, the CIA denied this, and the public, everybody else, the New York Times denied it, the Los Angeles, whatever they're called out there, denied it, and the Washington Post denied it, because none of them read the whole article, the whole hundreds of pages of baloney. And between paragraphs 942 and 989, there's this whole disclosure about the relationships of the CIA and the Crips in LA. That the next time he goes back to look at the document online has been taken out. There's a note that says paragraphs such and such and such and such have been taken away, but no one has access to it. So this is a way of setting up a viewfinder for people.
Instead of asking, as in the Quran you read, how do you think about it?
Yes.
Which is such an intimate question to me.
Well, it is. It's generous and beautiful. There are two people who are in this. It's like us. We're examining an issue together. We may not even know we're examining the same issue. And we get pissed off at one another and shit. But, you know, grumpy. But it's like we actually, after Sashin particularly, we really respect one another's effort at this. And we're more likely to say, how do you understand it, elder brother? Mm-hmm. How do you understand it, Elaine? You know, not like, I'm right. You know, not that. So, oh, you put the line on this way. I put the line on that way. I use the brush this way. Oh, I would write that sentence this way. So, many of these stories, as we become more familiar with them, are about this type of relationship that people have practiced together for a long time. And people are taking care of one another, even when they disagree. And how people, so you know, sometimes there's that feeling in Sashin where it feels like we're all moving together through the same fluid, sort of the same space. And my experience is that feels really good. So, but the interesting thing is that we're not, our focus when we come and as we work is not trying to make that feeling happen. Mm. It's not looking around at one another trying to move in relationship to one another. It's by actually entering ourselves and slowly being ground down by the form and our effort to resist, mm-hmm. that we submit and release into this space together and feel more like a pod of whales or what we imagine to be a school of fish or some birds in the sky or something. Most of us humans, most of the time, have lost our sensibility about that. How we are together in space and moving and breathing with one another. But even how we are in space with ourselves, the space of our lungs, the space of our breath, the space of our open chest, or our chin in, and the freedom of our our scalp or our head, you know, our eye. And as we pay attention to this, slowly we wake up to the already existing relationship that we're in. And as Robin pointed out, this changes the tenor of our interactions. And that's where things like the precepts come alive. Rather than some rule, they emerge out of conditioned co-arising. They actually emerge out of allowing emergence. If one way to look at it is if I am breathing the atmosphere, why would I be polluting the atmosphere? If I am breathing with trees, I'm exhaling CO2 and they're inhaling it and exhaling oxygen. Why would I mess that process up? If we're in relationship like that with one another, how could we break the precepts? The precepts are a way of understanding conditioned co-arising and emergence, and how it's already pre-expressing, pre-existing in our lives. Like Reb's big enlightenment, it's I and all being. Not even just all beings, all those individual, all beings, boom, blank. And then the speaking, the walking, the sharing, the livelihood, everything changes. It becomes, in a sense, in sync with the breathing. The sharing, the interdependence. So what we whackheads in Zen work on with all this form is gaining access to this always interdependent, this always pulsing, breathing, moving, which obviously we're totally resistant to, because we have this, I don't even know, I wouldn't call it kaka, but it's maybe, because we are individuals too, so there has to be some recognition of that in our lives. So, you know, yen is not wu, and wu is not yen. Yen says what yen says. Wu says what Wu says. That's all totally okay. And they coexist. And they don't interfere with one another. But mostly we think if we don't agree, we interfere with one another. Or if we don't agree, my view interferes with your view. Did you hear it?
If we don't agree.
Agree. I have a different view from yours, and yeah, our views can't coexist.
Yeah.
There has to be a right and a wrong, maybe. Or we say, okay, you can live over there, and I'll live over here. And maybe we'll bump into one another at the grocery store and smile. So let's see where they go next. So this is Yuan Wu's commentary. He does the pointer, the story he put in, and now he's doing a commentary on the story. Yun Yan and Dao Wu were fellow students under Yao Shan. For 40 years, Yun Yan's side did not touch his mat. It's pretty extreme, huh? I remember when I was a young guy reading about Chan monks who never slept. They had a meditation chin rest. They would sit and put it under their chin. And then, I don't know if they still have it in Japan, but so they would sit there and fall asleep with the chin rest. But we can interpret that more, I think, to say that his side didn't touch the mat. He cultivated continuous practice and didn't go on vacation. Or even when he was on vacation, he was cultivating continuous practice. I'm not of the school where we have to sit 23 hours a day in deep pain to gain access. I've done some of that crap, but it's more, how do we pay attention now? So Yao Shan produced the whole of the, so this is an important Soto story. Yao Shan produced the whole Cao Tung school. There were three men with whom the path of Dharma flourished. Descended from Yun Yan was Dong Shan, descended from Dao Wu was Shi Shuang, and descended from Chuan Tzu was Cao Shan. Cao and Dong, Dong Shan, in the old days, so it was. It's now pronounced in Chinese Cao Dong school. In Chinese, it used to be pronounced Cao Tung, T-S-A-O-U-T-U-N-G. And then, of course, in Japan, that turned into Soto. The Bodhisattva Great Compassion of Avalokiteshvara has 84,000 symbolic arms. Great Compassion has this many hands and eyes. Do all of you? Bao Chang said, all sayings and writings return to oneself. But leaving aside studying for the moment, under whom would you study? All sayings and writings return to oneself. Yun Yan often followed Dao Wu to study and ask questions to settle his discernment and certainty. One day he asked him, what does the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion use so many hands and eyes for? Boy, that's a bad English construction. Right at the start, Dao Wu should have given him a blow of the staff across his back to avoid so many complications appearing later. But Dao Wu was compassionate. He couldn't be like this. Instead, he gave Yun Yan an explanation of the reason, meaning to make him understand immediately. Instead of hitting him, Dao Wu said, it's like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow in the middle of the night. Groping for a pillow in the depths of the night without any lamplight. Tell me, where are the eyes? Yun Yan immediately said, I understand. That was quick. Wu said, how do you understand it? Yan said, all over the body are hands and eyes. Wu said, they don't repeat themselves. You have said quite a bit, but you have only said 80% of it. Yan said, what do you say, elder brother? Wu said, throughout the body are hands and eyes. But here's another question. But say, is all over the body right? Or is throughout the body right? Although they seem covered with mud, nevertheless, they are bright and clean. People these days often make up emotional interpretations. People these days, in the 10th century. probably not so different. Often make up emotional interpretations and say that all over the body is wrong, while throughout the body is right. They're merely chewing over ancients' words and phrases. They have died in the ancients' words, far from realizing that the ancients' meaning isn't in the words, and that all talk is used as something that can't be avoided. People these days add footnotes and set up patterns, saying that if they can penetrate this case, then this can be considered understanding, enough to put an end to study. Groping with their hands over their bodies and over the lamp and the pillar, they all make literal understanding of throughout the body. If you understand this way, you degrade the ancients quite a bit. Thus, it is said, he studies the living phrase. He doesn't study the dead phrase. You must cut emotional defilements in conceptual thinking. Become clean and naked, free and unbound. Only then will you be able to see the saying about great compassion. This is what the posture. Posture, the posture, the Zazen posture is about. So in the Fukan Zan Zenji, you know, it's like you sit here and you've got all this organized and everything and you're feeling pretty cool, and this is only like the periphery. You're just going around the edge. You're not diving into the abyss. This is talking about going into the abyss. This is the backward step into the abyss. Mm-hmm. We all think the abyss is over there somewhere. But we follow our breath. Mm-hmm. And with our breath comes everything in. With our breath, everything is exhaled. Haven't you heard how Cao Shan asked a monk, how is it when the Dharmakaya, the body of reality, is manifesting form in accordance with beings? Like the moon reflected in the water. This is really great. The monk said, like an ass looking at a well. Shan said, you've said quite a lot, but you've only said 80% of it. The monk said, what do you say, teacher? Sean said, it's like the well looking at the ass. This is the same meaning as the main case. If you go to their words to see, you'll never be able to get out of Dao Wu's and Yun Yan's trap. Shui Tu, as an adept, no longer dies in the words. I'm sorry. Earlier I said Yuan Wu, but actually it's Shui Tu.
Oh, darn.
Who compiled the Blue Cliff Records. I was thinking of the Book of Serenity. That's where Yuan Wu gets his day in court. Are they going to blow us up or something up there?
Yeah, I don't know.
Are there people out there with gizmos?
It's a herd of deer.
Oh, a herd of deer, that's fine.
Really?
Just as long as the Ghostbusters
aren't. Is the water turned off? That may be what's going on.
It's a herd of deer.
Cool.
Yeah.
You heard?
It was a herd.
Yeah. So if you go by their words to see, you'll never be able to get out of Daowu's and Yunyan's trap. Shui Tu, as an adept, no longer dies in the words. He walks right on Daowu's and Yunyan's heads to versify. So the process here, you know, is that as we study this and come alive in our authenticity, in our direct response, we are walking with these people, always. All the way back to big old Bud.
Bud.
This Bud's for you. This Bud is you.
Dude. You win the tomato.
I win the tomato.
He is the tomato.
All over the body is right. This is the verse. Four limbs, eight joints. This isn't yet the ultimate abode of patch-robed monks. Throughout the body is right. There's half on the forehead. You're still in the nest, blind. Bringing it up is still 100,000 miles away. It won't do to let Daowu or Yunyan go. Why only 100,000 miles? Spreading its wings, the rock, ROC, which is this mystical bird, soars over the clouds of the six compounds. I'm guessing that's earth, air, fire, water, metal. A tiny realm, I thought it would be extraordinary. Check. It propels the wind to beat against the waters of the four oceans. What speck of dust suddenly arises? What wisp of hair hasn't stopped? You don't see? The net of jewels hanging down in patterns reflects reflections upon reflections. Where do the hands and eyes on the staff come from? Bah! It's quite lovely, you know. It's weird. Mm-hmm. It's a weird literature. And seriously, I mean, if you compare it to other religious literature, parables and all that baloney, like, you know, Joe, I don't know what Franklin said or something, it doesn't give you a foot to stand on.
Yeah.
It doesn't tell you. Oh, the moral of the story is...
It makes you work.
Yeah. It's designed to break us apart.
It's so performative.
Yeah.
That I can really see how Bhutto performance work is related to this, because yeah. There's so many suggestions
so
in the text.
So, one sec.
Yeah.
Do you guys know what Bhutto is?
No.
So, Bhutto is a Japanese dance form that is often referenced as the dance of death. It evolved in 60s Japan and is a very, I find, fascinating contrast to what I perceived as 60s rebellion. And a great deal of it had to do with a response to post-nuclear Japan in the war. And there were these two characters that remind me could very well be characters talking in a koan dialogue whereby a guy by the name of Ono and Tashigiro, I believe that's the right name. Anyway, these guys were amazing and kind of wild and combined aspects of no, bunraku, and certainly Zen. And it is a performance art, a dance form. They don't always consider it just a dance form, that comes from the ground up, and a lot of it is performed very close to the ground. And as instead of aspiring to the heavens, which we know that Western ballet often does, Bhutto reaches down into the earth, into the mother. And these
this
guys...
This is where Jizo is.
Yeah.
Jizo is the earth store bodhisattva. Kshitigarbha is the earth store bodhisattva who vowed, Dazan in China, who vowed not to leave hell until all beings in hell were released. This is going into our guts and intestines. Okay.
These guys performed into their 90s in whiteface, similar to the no things that are you would see in NOH theater.
Drama.
You can see them on YouTube. And there's a couple of great documentaries on it also. Yeah.
Okay. Now, end parens. Have we distracted you totally from what you were originally going to say? The relationship between Zen and
Bhutto. Yes, yeah, totally.
Good work.
Good, yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what I was going to say other than... these dialogues that you're speaking of reference the body in ways that they're so visual to me. Where else can you go to a parable and go like, yeah, eyes, ears, nose, mouth, tongue, all over the body, you know? I find that just amazing, really amazing, and also funny, you know?
So it's amazing. So how does a line like that emerge from our practice? Mm-hmm. How is it a teaching tool? What is this pedagogy?
What is this?
Pedagogy. So,
what is pedagogy?
Teaching.
Oh.
You know, I come from Camberville. We're sophisticated up there. We say pedagogy.
We say that in Brooklyn, too.
Oh, you do?
Okay. Get us your high horse.
We say that in New Jersey, too.
Okay, very good. I'm glad to hear. Probably not in Howell, though.
Oh, maybe not, no.
Anyway, so what is this? and it's so intriguing to us. I mean, for those of us who stick around, it hooks us in some way.
What, the Cohen study?
Yeah. But this practice that begins to speak this way, you know, that is different from, I know this information and I'm telling you this information.
Yeah, it's not telling at all.
It forces you out of your customary way of understanding things.
Yeah.
That's what it does for me.
Yeah.
I'm typically analytical, and so I analyze, but then you get to a point where there's nothing, it defies analysis.
Mm.
And so you're up against something that it's like trying to stop an avalanche.
Yeah.
And looking at it and seeing it coming and knowing at some point it's futile to either stand or to run. There's nothing left to do. It's like being in the middle of a burning house. You're in the center and the entire periphery of the house is on fire. What are you going to do? You die. That's the only thing left to do. So right. I've done this, like, literally several times.
Died?
Know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so sometimes without even knowing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like getting run over by the car or something
uh-huh.
like that.
You're a boss.
What can I do? And then there's a point at which, you know, there's nothing you can do. It happened one time when I was in Costa Rica and I was hiking up this waterfall and I had hired a guide and he brought his younger brother and he was swinging on these, what are these things called?
Vines,
thank you. And I was just like enjoying the environment and I turned and I looked and 16-year-old Ramon was swinging and he was about from where I am to the altar. And he was probably going about 25 miles an hour on the vine. And I knew that within a split second, he was going to hit me. And he did. And he knocked me over, and I fell over backwards and shattered all the bones in my wrist. And I just lie on the ground thinking, well, what was there to do? There's nothing to do. This is what has happened. And then got carried out of the jungle and went back to the ranch and they said, you want to call an ambulance or do you want to fly to the hospital? The nearest hospital being in Golfito, which was 500 miles away. So I said, fly. And they said, oh, well then you'll have to wait till tomorrow because it's too late in the day to fly. So I said, ambulance. So. It took 14 hours. But this is very similar. I feel like, you know, when I try to analyze these things, my head just catches on fire. So I just stop and lie down and eat a peach.
So these stories, we have to enter them through our actual practice. They appear like in space.
Like
they appear like in space.
Yeah.
They don't succumb to analysis. They're like vipassana. They occur like insight. As we effectively perform shamatha, settling and clearing, insight occurs. And it often takes a hell of a long time for us to settle.
Years.
And that's the story of these stories. That's the interaction. That's the commitment. That's the effort. Just like how we wake up in one body or one space in Sesshin. But this is each person over some extended period of time. So, you know how it is when you meet someone you know, but you've never met before. The practice sets it up so that actually we never leave one another. I remember there's some line about about Suzuki Roshi says, you know, that you may think you may want to leave Tassajara and you may walk up that road. But you can never leave.
Well, we were saying the same about people who take Jukai and never
yes.
show up again.
Yeah.
That you cannot show up, but you really can't leave.
Exactly.
You know, it'll be with you.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. This is.
And
this
we just
is,
have to wait and
yeah.
see.
This is. That's a, you know, it's so crazy. So Robert Wright comes out with this book, Buddhism is true. No. But and then Adam Gopnik responds, and critical thought and analytical relationship, and expressing some. I believe Robert Wright has done some practice, but one wouldn't say he was a practitioner that he's responding to and writing about. And I'm just guessing because I haven't read the book. I've been told about it, but I know Robert Wright's writing. And he's intelligent and insightful and helpful. I'm trying to remember where I was going.
But if you say Buddhism is true...
Oh, I know.
Then what's false? I mean, you know, we're giving it a value.
Yeah, so this is an important thing. So you see, this is where Zen goes. Like. This is where analytic people would call it's like
cold one.
What I haven't said yet, but what analytical people might call like magic or spirituality. This sense of time and ripening and coming forth that it happens. It's not something, you know, like the idea, the modern idea of mastery is do something for 10,000 hours and you're a master. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But Zen defies that. Mm. We don't know. We don't know when the rice will be done. Mm. Or if it's ever done. Mm. When does the rice give up?
Or maybe the person who doesn't come back after taking Jukai gets ripened.
Yes, other ways.
Yes.
No, this is incredibly important, which is why the Sangha always has to be open.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think you want to separate us from them.
Yeah.
You know, that's a big mistake.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, Dogen Zen is based on not making that mistake.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. So
I met a guy in a bar in Rincon, Puerto Rico, who I've known for, I don't know, 10 years. And we were sitting out front on Thursday night is art walk night. Everybody comes to town and artists show their stuff. And we were having a beer, and his name was Trey Cravey. And I don't know why, but we were sitting there with this other guy named Phil Painter from Massachusetts. And Trey just started to describe this Buddhist existential view of the world, and he said, "This is really how it is." And I was just...
Painter isn't a cardiologist, is he?
Phil, no.
No, okay. Because I know a painter who's.
It might be related. It's an old Massachusetts last name.
Yeah.
I was just kind of blown away, you know, because I don't think this guy ever walked into Zendo, but he really had it down. Now you could say, "Well, that was just an intellectual interpretation," but it's stunning when you meet people like that. Like, oh my God.
So, you see, the freedom here is that bodhisattvas appear in all forms. Hmm. Bodhisattvas ripen people, ripen beings in all forms. Bodhisattvas appear in children's wards and hospitals as children dying. Bodhisattvas appear in old age homes. Bodhisattvas appear in Goldman Sachs.
Excuse me, I would like to just say that yesterday, while I was
at Goldman Sachs,
at Goldman Sachs, I met the Rutgers football team, who I never saw such big guys in my life. I never went to a football game. I couldn't believe how big these guys were. And they were playing with these little toddlers. It was surreal. And
so they came to the hospital?
They came to the hospital. dressed up in their jerseys. Yeah. And were working with this outrageous mother, like totally on the spectrum, and they were like just doing whatever she requested. They had no idea what they were doing it, but they were doing it completely. They were just beautiful, these guys, but very, very big. You were that big? I mean, these guys...
No, no, that's why I stopped playing football.
You need to consider a little guy.
Wow.
That's why I stopped playing football.
Because you weren't that... I mean, these guys were outrageous.
Growth hormones. But I mean, they weren't as huge when I played as they are now.
Yeah,
I wasn't big enough to play the position. But, you know, my life would have been totally different if I was 6'4".
They were more than that.
I know.
Yeah, they were.
No, they're like 6'7", 340 pounds.
Yeah.
And they run a 4'5", 40.
I never saw such big people, actually.
Yeah.
You don't want to try to tackle one on a football field.
No, anyway. I don't think that's...
Yeah, but so there's something in them that comes forward. So you see, this is, to me, what Suzuki Roshi was addressing in Most Request.
To come forward.
When that comes forward. And our job, our mission, if we so choose to accept it, is tapping our inmost request and making it possible for others to tap their inmost request. This is a bodhisattva. And we trust that an inmost request isn't how to rip off the Fed.
Although there's no proof.
Although there's no evidence.
Well, I will tell you it was 5:15.
Okay.
So I just want to add
time
something
marches
because
on, it's petty pace.
There is Norman wrote an article maybe a couple of years ago in Lion's Roar, and it is about reaching behind you for the pillow. And I know that because I read it recently because I did a drawing on a pillow that was based on that phrase from that poem. And he really works with it in a beautiful kind of way, leaving behind a lot of the other parts of the poem because it's about working with phrases, which is very helpful to me.
Well, I wanted to add, thank you. Are you finished?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I'm sorry. In that little story that I was telling about the kid on the vine, there's like a moment of, you know that there's nothing you can do to avoid this, and you just surrender, and then bam. I've had this happen, you know, with a needle in my arm, knowing that I was going to pass out and not sure if I was going to wake up, you know, things like that. Here it goes, and just getting knocked down. And I used to fight a lot, you know, with my hands. And
what did your hands do to you?
Huh?
Mr. Literal over here.
And I'm sure with your great size and massive strength that...
You gave it to yourself.
That you were very successful.
Yeah. I have been knocked out more times than I can count.
At CBGB's? In the neighborhood.
In the neighborhood, yeah. But it's, you know, having this happen over and over again, it's just...
scary man.
It becomes sort of surreal. And then, I don't paint or draw or anything like this, but it has lent itself to sort of, you know, like Brian's saying, this existential, like, where am I, what's going on, I don't know what's happening. You become sort of ungrounded.
Yeah.
There's no way to explain. And it's just... everything becomes inexplicable. You just hear over and over again. And then you, for me anyway, beginning to adapt and not trying to resist it or get a ground, you know, to hold on to. I always thought it's a really tough way to learn, you know, but... I don't advocate it, you know, getting, like, knocked out and...
This is why, you know, what was the story about the woman who gave her life to work in the brothel? Ed Hawkwind asked him, she sold herself to a brothel so she could support her family. She met Hawkwind, asked Hawkwind something like, can enlightenment happen anywhere? And he said yes. And she devoted herself to her contract and being a Buddhist, practicing in the brothel, and became a Zen teacher.
But she also was scared of lightning.
Yeah, okay. So tell me.
So she was sitting on the terrace during a lightning storm, the lightning struck right in front of her and knocked her out when she woke up.
She had an experience.
But that's common.
This can happen. Strange. This happened to me on a football field. Mm. Not lightning, but a sense of incredible space and consciousness and awareness of everything. And giving everything to a moment and getting lost, totally lost in a moment, and yet trusting. But it happens to people. It happens to people on a battlefield.
Yeah,
we're all on a battlefield. Mm-hmm. Where all of a sudden everything stops.
Mm-hmm. And it's slow-mo.
And it's, you know? So there's the possibility that the black kid from Alabama in Afghanistan has this turning experience. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying you should sign up for the military, blah, 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 blah.
But that might make him more likely to re-up.
Yeah, it could. No, seriously, because the football players get addicted to the peak experience, which is the other side of this. So most, if you look at the history of Zen in the West and some of the ways it's been sold, it's about Americans going after peak experiences.
Yeah.
And the way Suzuki Roshi sold it was not that. It's a little bit like, okay, so everybody has these, and what are you going to do with your life? Not like life is boring, but let's not have to do extraordinary things. Let's take care of one another right where we are.
Just to let you know that Paula's back.
Oh, great. She landed from Paris?
Yes.
Okay. Send her our love.
Yeah. I will do that.
That was a... So the experience of the eighth ox herding picture where there's the circle and nothing in it. Mm-hmm. That's why on one level... the space we're talking about is like flatlining. It's like while that's a experience, the job of your teacher is to kick you out of that space. Mm-hmm. So when you do shamatha well enough, it's like that's calling to you. It's like a siren song. It's like love. But we have to do two more steps. We have to get out of that hole, the hole that is let go of who we thought we were, and then the one that identifies with this experience, and then begins to walk down the mountain. And be able to just stand with people and be with people wherever we are. And be present with people and hear people's lives. And hear our lives. Without trying to be someplace else. with that, we'll send our love to Paula.
I'm sending it right now.
Okay. And we'll say something like, what is it, how's it going? May our intentions
equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless